This is Bronwyn Schwagert, licensed therapist and author at the Angry at the Right Things podcast. Instead of controlling our anger, we'll be looking at what causes it in the first place so we can rectify what's dysfunctional in our lives and in the world. Here we go. Hello, Angry at the Right Things listeners. Welcome to this beautiful Memorial Day weekend. It is Monday, May the 29th, and I'm here with Katie Wonder.
Hello.
And you know what we just did, guys? We just read the lyrics of a really cool song together, kind of. Well, Katie read them on her phone and I read them on my computer, but we were in the same room. And the song is called Dear Wormwood. It is a song by a band called the Oh Hellos. And I wanted to share it with Katie and I wanted to just talk about it today because it's a really profound song. The lyrics are really meaningful and very relevant to, I think, all of us. What do you think, Katie? What are your initial thoughts since you just read it for the first time? And
oh, they definitely speak to me for sure. I don't know how they would feel to other people, but to me, I feel like they're talking about me.
Okay. You really felt especially like they were talking about you. You had mentioned the one part, and I'm going to go ahead and read part of it. I won't read the whole song, but I'm just reading it online right here. It's called Dear Wormwood, which is a book by C.S. Lewis. It's from a book by C.S. Lewis called The Screwtape Letters. And those of you who have read The Screwtape Letters in high school or college, a lot of professors assign it. The Screwtape Letters is a book about two demons having a conversation via letters. And the main demon is named Screwtape. And he is writing to his his nephew, Wormwood. And so every other letter in there, I think, like starts with Dear Wormwood. And so they're demons and their job is to tempt the people they have been appointed. And so what you're reading when you read the book is Screwtape's advising his counsel to this younger demon named Wormwood on how to best tempt the person that he's in charge of, which is like some young man, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So it's like he's like his demon in training.
He's a demon in training, yes. Right. And it's a really profound book. Definitely recommend reading it. People love this book, people who are religious and people who are not love this book. It's just very, what's the word? Provocative. It's very insightful. It's very.
Yeah. And every time you read it, you see things in it that you didn't see before. I think. And you see, at first you see other people in it. Mm-hmm. And then the more you read it, the more you might see yourself. Mm-hmm.
And it's so relatable is the word I left out. It's very relatable. And so this song called Dear Wormwood by the Oh Hellos is talking about, it's a letter or a song written to the younger demon in training by the singer, by the musician, by the author, whoever it is. And he says at one point, there before the threshold, I saw a brighter world beyond myself. And in my hour of weakness, you were there to see my courage fail. For the years have been long and you have taught me well to sit and wait, planning without acting, steadily becoming what I hate. And that was the part you responded to, Katie, that you felt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Chilling.
Chilling?
Yes.
And then it goes on and it says, I know who you are now. I know who you are. I know who you are now. I have always known you. You have been there in my mind, but now I understand you and I will not be part of your designs. I know who I am now and all that you've made of me. I know who you are now, and I name you my enemy. And then the last stance says, I know who I am now. I know who I want to be. I want to be more than this devil inside of me. So can you tell me your reflections on what it, the lyrics do for you personally?
First it just makes me think of all these things, all these ideas and thoughts that I have and have had. I would say I've been struggling with this all my adult life. The person I want to be and the person I actually am. And the things I wish I would do or wished I'd done and would still like to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not doing. I'm held back for some reason by fear, maybe of failure or not being perfect, not being able to do it well. So not doing it at all. My husband said something very interesting to me yesterday, which really relates to this. Just kind of out of the blue. I don't know what we were talking about, but he made some comment about, like, you know, you're going to go to the good place. And I shook my head like, no. And he's like, what? You don't see yourself like that? Like someone that would go to the good place, you know? Yeah. And I said, no, I don't see myself like that at all. And he was really surprised by that. And he said, why? What have you done?
Wow.
And I said, oh. He goes, oh, it's not what you've done. It's what you haven't done, isn't it?
Oh, wow.
And I said, yeah, exactly. Really? Like, I don't feel so much like I've committed terrible, you know, acts that prevent me from going to the quote-unquote good place. It's more the things I haven't done. The relationships I haven't maintained, the creative pursuits that I haven't pursued.
Yeah.
He was really struck by that. And so was I. He's like, oh, I never thought about that before. And we were both thinking that would be kind of a good, like, get to know you question to ask people. Like, you know, do you regret more the things you've done in your life or the things that you haven't done?
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's kind of sums up how I feel about what those song lyrics touch on.
Okay. So that first stanza that I read that says, for the years have been long and you have taught me well to sit and wait, planning without acting, steadily becoming what I hate. You really relate to.
I do. And I'm coming very close upon my 50th birthday. And so that really, really resonates with me right now. Yeah. Because when I was younger, I think I still had that very comfortable illusion of, oh, I've got time. I've got so much time. I'm young. You know, I have all this time. But once you hit these kind of milestones, it's sort of like right in your face, like, maybe I don't have so much time. Maybe I need to get going.
Wow. Katie, that's amazing. That makes a lot of sense. That's really cool that Steve, your husband, could be that kind of mirror for you to understand where you're coming from and even to draw upon that distinction between your husband, Steve, who thinks he's hellbound in his mind because he's done a lot of bad things. And for him to realize, no, you feel like you're hellbound. And we're saying hellbound very loosely here, but because you haven't maybe been responsible for yourself in some way.
Use a word I really don't like, proactive, you know, just so,
I don't hear proactive. I hear alive, embodied.
As opposed to what's the apathy, you know? Apathy. Yeah.
So this wormwood is a demon of apathy, at least in this song, in part, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's what I see in it, because that's my sin, I guess, that I really struggle with.
And that makes us less alive.
Yeah.
And it's not about a should. It's more about just a sadness of not realizing who we are, not embodying ourselves fully.
Like the I am my own worst enemy. Like I'm being my own worst enemy by not trying and going for the things that I would like to try, you know?
So it's interesting too, the lyrics, when he says, I have always known you. You have always been there in my mind. But now I understand you and I will not be part of your designs. That really speaks to me, because I feel like as a therapist, what I'm helping to do is my clients, it's helping their eyes be opened and kind of, it's like a waking up. It's kind of like this is how things actually are.
Right.
This is how others actually are. And this is how I actually am.
Seeing yourself clearly, right? Which is, it's one thing to see the other people in your life clearly, but it's a whole other level of painful sometimes to see yourself clearly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I like that it says, but now I understand you and I will not be part of your designs. And what that makes me think of is the two wolves parable.
Oh, right. Remind me of that.
The again. Two wolves. Yes. So there is a little parable where there's an elderly Native American grandfather who is speaking to his grandson, and he tells his young grandson, you know, grandson, inside every person, there's a good wolf and a bad wolf. And the good wolf or the bad wolf, you know, is everything evil. It's greed. It's arrogance. It's violence. It's cruelty. All these things. And then the good wolf is everything good. It's everything beautiful. It's humility. It's kindness. It's compassion. It's patience. It's empathy. And the little boy says, well, grandpa, which wolf wins? Mm. And the grandfather says, the one you feed, grandson. It's the one you feed. And so to me, when I love that parable, because I really believe that inside all of us, our entire lives, there are two wolves. And so as a therapist, it's helping those people wake up to, oh yeah, there's a bad wolf in me. And it's not about pretending it's not there. That doesn't do anyone any good. It's about starving it. It's about having to first identify and be aware of it. So we can intentionally starve it, so we can intentionally feed the good wolf.
Right.
And so when he says this lyric, but now I understand you and I will not be part of your designs, it's like there's this kind of wake up, this understanding, this realization, this recognition. And when we have that, we have this level of objectivity.
Right.
To distance ourselves from it. And that's what I hear him saying is, I'm not going to be a part of you. I'm going to be me and I'm going to detach from you. And I'm not going to be part of your designs, which is like a scheme, because there is a scheme, there's a strategy. I'm going to have my own strategy and scheme. Mm-hmm. And there's that kind of pulling away. Yes. But the pulling away cannot happen unless there's first the realization.
Yes.
Right?
The waking up.
The waking up.
You have to wake up first. Yeah, I've been thinking about that lately because my husband is always kind of poking fun at me a little bit because I've always been someone that reads like self-help books, and he kind of turns his nose up at those things a bit. And that's fine. But he'll often just say, you know, you're always searching. You're always searching. And I admire that. I know you want to be a better person, but you just got to live. You just got to live your life, you know? And I'm like, I get what he's saying. Yeah. I get it. I lost my train of thought. What was I going to say about that? Oh, I just kind of had this realization recently about, and I think it has to do with coming alive. Mm. Like, instead of looking for the right mantra or the right person's book to, you know, frame my worldview around, I need to make up my own worldview. Mm. I need to. And that's coming alive, kind of like, I can take pieces from these different people that speak to me, whether it's a, you know, Native American folk tale, like the one you just told about the two wolves, or, you know, whether it's something Glennon Doyle said in her podcast or whatever, I can piece together those pieces for myself to be in a way that helps me be alive. Like, I don't have to.
Is that part of trusting yourself?
I think so. Yeah. Kind of like, no, I don't have to follow anybody else's rules. I get to make the rules for myself. And part of making the rules for myself is taking the pieces that work for me, that put the puzzle together for me. So that's what I need to do.
And that's been your latest epiphany
kind of. Yeah. Yeah. I kind of saw it as like, you know, little like post-it notes, like all stuck together. Like, but I put them together myself the way I want them.
You know, it makes me think of a quilt.
Yeah.
Like there's all these pieces of fabric.
Yeah.
And you choose which pieces of fabric.
Yeah.
And you know which ones you're going to have, but you make the quilt yourself. Like you decide which goes where.
I have to do it. And it has to be, they have to be chosen by me or it's not going to work. They're just going to fall off, you know?
I see.
Yeah.
But the overarching quilt is your doing in your timing because those different strips of fabric come from different time periods.
Right.
And they represent different things that are a part of you.
Yes.
And are sourced elsewhere.
Yeah.
But the whole quilt is in your timing.
Yeah. And it only really works when it's all together.
All together.
Like, you know, any one piece isn't going to do it. You know?
Yeah.
It all has to work together.
I love that.
Yeah.
So I love this song and I really wanted to share that with you. And it also made me think of a couple other things that I wrote down, actually. Because last time, Katie, you and I talked about, you kind of alluded to people in your life that you want to maybe apologize to at some point, but you're afraid of what those conversations might look like. And this is a theme I see in my clients as well. And, you know, and I, of course, face myself. So I wrote down a little something. I wrote fear of other people's anger, especially people we know we failed or betrayed in some way. How attempting to circumvent this causes us to abandon ourselves as well as them and shortchange everyone of potential for real relationship and reconciliation. I wrote that. And then
that's really good. I like your use of the word circumvent.
That's circumvent.
Yeah. Yeah. That really describes like all the things my mind tries to do to kind of get around it, you know, like,
is it like a fire that you're like staying on the edge of?
You're just afraid, right? Like how can I like get close without getting burned, I guess?
And is the being burned the potential for the other people's anger?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Or just flat out rejection, maybe, you know? Yeah.
And what would make you feel safer if that were the outcome? Is there anything to safeguard you against being burned or being burned for more than you could withstand?
Right. I don't I don't know. That's a good question.
I mean, that's always the risk. But it sounds like you're at the place where you are not in a place of denial, pretending there's nothing to apologize for. You're not in that place. That wake up has happened.
Right.
It's more the denial or the avoidance of their anger at you.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is different.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's kind of that place of being willing to, and it's a hard place to get to, being willing to say I'm sorry without having to also say, but you hurt me too, you know, just being able to say, I'm sorry, period. And not have to say, you know, that.
Yeah.
That's a hard place to
go. It's super hard. I wrote something else about that too, actually. Because Katie, you know that I got in a big fight with my daughter, who's 19, a few weeks ago. And I felt very betrayed by her in the moment. And, but I reflected back on the whole event and it made me see, I don't feel like in that moment I did something I regret or said anything I regret, but what fed into her overall ongoing chronic resentment of me was something I was able to kind of, see more clearly after that fight and understand more clearly. And that led me to write her a letter that is called Dear 5-Year-Old Edie.
Oh.
Because I did write her an apology letter to her 5-year-old self.
Okay.
And I shared it with her.
Oh.
And I don't know if she read it or not yet.
Okay.
And I don't know what her response was. And I'm okay with not knowing. But yeah. I mean, I really think that since she was 5 years old, she has in part seen me as an enemy because I think I really did betray her. A couple of big life events for her. One is our dog died when she was 5, our dog Griffin. And I really didn't think it affected her that much. And I was a fool because it did. She has not been a highly emotional, obviously highly emotional kid. So I didn't see it myself at the time, but it really did affect her. And I completely dropped the ball on even giving her a platform to share with me what that did to her at that time. Like I completely dismissed her feelings and just assumed she didn't have many because she wasn't showing many.
Right.
So that was the first thing. And the second thing was we moved to Oakland. And I, as you know, quickly fell into such a steep descent to a very low place myself. I, again, didn't think it affected her because she didn't show any outward signs herself.
Right.
But I absolutely think it did affect her. And I absolutely think I emotionally abandoned her during that time. And I think she's never gotten over it.
Right, right.
And I think there's ongoing resentment even this day, even though we have a great relationship in the here and now, now. But I think I need to, you know, come clean with her. I think I owe her that. I think I owe her a deep, heartfelt apology. And I wrote her a letter to her 5-year-old self. And I just said, I was such a fool. I was so self-absorbed. I can't believe, you know, something like a move to Oakland made me so depressed and made me so sick. And I just assumed it didn't affect you at all. Like, what the hell? What was I thinking?
You were so lost. You didn't, you know.
Well, and I think that is a very common thing that as parents, we, if our kid isn't showing us with their, you know, with their voice or with their tears that they're sad or they're struggling, I think it's easy to neglect them emotionally and just assume they're okay.
It's kind of like, you know, you always hear, oh, kids are strong. Kids are resilient.
Oh, God.
And they are, but that's not necessarily a good thing, right? Like they're really good at
it. That doesn't entitle us to emotionally abandon them.
It doesn't protect them just because they're strong.
Right.
Doesn't mean that they're not in pain.
So I don't know what level of pain she was in, but I know that I betrayed her in both of those regards. And so I wrote her a letter apologizing and saying, you know, 5-year-old Edie, I wish I could sit you on my lap right now. I would cover your face with kisses and tears. And I'm so sorry. And I want to make this up to you. And I hope I can earn back your trust and your faith.
Yeah.
And I hope 5-year-old Edie, that this doesn't rob you of your own flourishing in life. My failure to attune to you doesn't keep you from developing trusting relationships with others in the future, because that's what trauma does. It destroys our future based on the past. Right. And I said, I hope my own failings in your life do not keep you from having the life you deserve.
Yeah, that's good.
So that was my heartfelt apology. And again, I don't know her response, but I did write this after that. I wrote, an apology is the beginning of rebirth and resurrection. It requires a posture of truth towards ourselves and humility, but not humiliation. It's ground zero, and it sets us free. The worst type of lie is a self-lie of self-deception, which we term denial. Mm. It's a cocoon that serves a purpose for a time, as in dissociation,
right?
In order for us to survive. But if we stay enveloped within it, there's no metamorphosis, only death. When we give a heartfelt apology, we feel so vulnerable and naked, just like an emerging butterfly or a baby chick. It's frightening and risky, but to stay inside means inevitable death and decay.
Mm. Wow. That's really heavy, but really good. I like that a lot.
And, I really mean that. It requires humility, but not humiliation. And I think those are things that humans really get confused.
Oh, I think you're right. Right? Like admitting that you've made a mistake is somehow means you're, I don't know.
You're shameful.
Yeah, you're shameful. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
That's what it is. Unredeemable.
Right. Something. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, the word humility comes from the root word humus, which is soil. It's an old English word for soil.
Oh.
It's spelled H-U-M-M-U-S, humus. And that comes from the same root word as human.
Mm.
Humans come from the soil.
Oh, wow.
And are made to be humble and have humility. Humiliation, though, that comes from shame. So to be humble is to say, yeah, you know what? I'm an asshole sometimes.
Right.
I totally blew it. But humiliation is that all or nothing, inability to be human, inability to face our humanity, right. Inability to say, no, I made a mistake. It doesn't mean I am a mistake. Those are two different things.
You're right. It seems like that to me, there's definitely a strong link between humiliation and anger, and not in a good way, like in a lashing out kind of way, because being humiliated is just so painful, right? Like,
I think it's human nature. So again, we all have a good wolf and a bad wolf, all of us.
Right.
And I think it's human nature that most humans, if not all, that our bad wolf needs something to put down in order to feel superior.
Yes.
I notice this with my clients. They'll tell me, so there's a lot of words that apply here. So it could be that we need to shame someone else. It could be that we need to humiliate someone. It could be ridicule. The word belittle works very well. Judge. Mm-hmm. For me, my word that I'm learning about myself, my dark wolf or my bad wolf, condescend.
Oh.
Yeah. I didn't realize that I was part of this phenomenon myself, but I realized like we all do this. We all, I would say, you know, I'm an idealist. I'm just an idealist, Steve, which is my husband. Mm-hmm. I'm just an idealist. And now I'm like, yeah, but you sound really condescending as your idealist self, always finding fault with everything,
right?
That's not ideal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So condescend. And even depend upon, I think, there's a weird dynamic where I see people will depend on others overly in a way to kind of dominate them.
Ah.
So I see this with all humans in some way. And I know now I do it myself. I know my daughter Edie has seen me do that my entire life. Be my idealist self, but that means condescending or judging with my words everyone else that doesn't meet my ideal.
Right.
And now I get why she resents the hell out of me sometimes. I get it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. I've got a bad wolf too. Three, I do. But you know what? But admitting that isn't as hard as it used to be, because I know now that we're all human. We all have the bad wolf, and that doesn't make me shameful. It just makes me human like everyone else. And now that I'm more aware, I can intentionally try to starve it more.
Right.
Right.
It's like the world is, as much as when we're kids, we want everything to be evil, simple, right? Like good and evil. And, but ultimately the more you live, you realize like there aren't really heroes and villains. There's just people, right? And people are a mixture of all those things. And we can choose to be, like you said, to feed the good wolf or the bad wolf, right?
It's who we feed, yeah. Right. Yeah, I guess kind of going back to you were saying the quilt. I like to think of humans as a mosaic.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Made up of lots of little pieces.
Lots of little pieces. And yeah, it's about being a mosaic. It's about being authentic. It's about being awake and aware and not pretending and not feeling like we have to pretend. It's about knowing that we're lovable and good enough as is. We don't need to earn it. There's no metric for good enough. There's no enough to the good enough.
Right.
You know? Yeah, it's about all those things. And there's freedom in that. And there's freedom for me now to have more heartfelt apologies to my daughter and my husband. You know, I realized the other day we were biking together and I was like, while we're biking, and you know, I joke that I need to listen to a podcast when I'm biking because I just need my mind needs stuff to do all the time to think about, right?
Yeah.
And I remember we were biking uphill and I'm like, out of nowhere, I totally condescend to my husband all the time. And not to say that he doesn't do that to me in other ways.
Right.
You know, right. He likes to criticize everything about, not everything, a lot of things.
Right.
So he has his own, we call it narcissistic play.
So it's kind of like we're all controlling our own narrative all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It's a narcissistic supply, though, is what it is. It's a need to feel superior by putting someone else down in some way.
Right.
And he does it, and I do it, and everyone does it.
Yeah.
Right?
But being aware that you do it, right, is huge.
Being aware. Like,
just catching yourself.
Owning it.
Yeah, I'm always going to have this tendency, but I can starve it. Right? I don't have to feed it.
I can come out of the closet as human, I guess, right? Yeah. And then I also want to talk a little bit about another revelation I've had recently.
Okay.
So, you know, about a week ago, my mom died.
Yes.
And I'm doing great. And it wasn't a shock. You know, she was declining for several years and she couldn't have a conversation. She couldn't even speak for a long time. But when I learned that she actually passed from my dad a couple hours afterwards, the first place my mind went, and I heard it on a voicemail, first place my mind went was, oh my God, my dad.
Right.
And I was feeling in my mind, I was feeling my dad's feelings.
Yes.
And I had to catch myself. And I told Steve, I said, wait, I am feeling my dad's feelings right now for my dad who's lost his wife of 54 years. But I need to feel my feelings right now because I have lost my mom of 52 years.
Right.
And I can't do both.
No.
And I just caught myself. I'm like, oh my God, I am feeling my dad's feelings. And guess what? Feeling his feelings right now isn't helping him. And it's not helping me.
Right.
And so I had this revelation of, and I see this in my clients too, what I now term dysfunctional empathy. Dysfunctional empathy.
Oh,
yeah.
I like that.
I like having a term for it.
I feel like being a mother and a wife, and maybe just a woman, I feel like I have a lot of dysfunctional empathy that prevents me from sort of advocating for myself and being myself. Like,
yes. So I think dysfunctional empathy, a lot of people say, oh, I'm an empath, you know, and
oh, good gravy.
Right. Well, let me see.
Oh, no, please go on.
Okay.
Yeah.
What I hear is people will say, oh, I'm an empath. They'll say to me, I could never do your job and be a therapist because I'm too much of an empath. But when they say that, I know what they're talking about. They're talking about dysfunctional empathy.
Yes. Okay. The reason I said, oh, good gravy is because someone very close to me identifies as an empath, and I'm not going to go into that.
Okay.
That's why I
chuckled.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think a lot of people identify, but they'll say, I could never be a therapist. Like, I don't know how you do it. I'm too much of an empath. And what I say back now is no, you're a dysfunctional empath. I don't say this.
Yeah.
I want to say this.
Yes.
In my mind, I say this. I only have functional empathy. Obviously, I just gave you an example of having dysfunctional empathy for my father instead of for me when my mother died, who happens to be his wife. So obviously I struggle with it too. But in general, what I realize is real functional empathy is when you're with that person, you are asking them how they're doing, you're giving them space to talk, and you're imagining their feelings, maybe the feelings they're not actually saying with their words, but you're imagining what those are. You're feeling them with them, and maybe you're naming those feelings. Like, you must feel shocked. You must feel betrayed right now. You must feel helpless, right?
Right.
And you're naming those feelings, and that gives them permission to feel them fully and completely, and they're not alone in their feelings anymore. And what's shareable is bearable. So now those feelings are in part evaporated. They're in part, gone. They're lifted because you've given them this space, this empathic space with you.
Right.
So have them to feel them and what we call feel and deal.
Yes.
And that is functional empathy. That's it. Okay. That's it. So when we imagine, so my mom just died, and I have a lot of friends who I can tell are having dysfunctional empathy for me right now, because they're doing the dysfunctional empathy thing of like imagining what I'm feeling without asking me.
Right.
Just imagining at these random times, maybe while they're driving their kids to school or while they're going grocery shopping, they're just putting themselves in my shoes, feeling what they think are my feelings,
right,
which are not necessarily my feelings. And then they're feeling them. And then they're so drained because of all this dysfunctional empathy that doesn't help me and it doesn't help them. And now they're way too drained to actually call me up and help me feel my actual feelings and be present with me.
Right.
So the real empathy, the functional empathy to do me any good or any benefit.
Do you think, why do you think that is? I mean, is that, or is it to do with projecting?
Yeah.
Do you think sometimes they're projecting their own feelings, like in this situation, how they're going to feel when their mother passes away?
Absolutely.
Or why do you think it's that we're not taught like how to properly empathize with people?
Absolutely.
It's just, it's something that almost really needs to be like modeled, and we don't know how to do this.
To make explicit, we need to talk about, because yeah, Katie, when my friend texts me, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I've been thinking about you." And I'm like, "I'm doing great. What are you talking about? I'm glad my mom's finally at peace. I'm so glad. And I feel at peace." And you're coming from this place where obviously you're feeling what you think I'm feeling for me, and it's making you sick, and it's keeping you from being there for me.
Right. Right. Well, I have an example. Like when I came to see you last Sunday, I thought in my mind, should I say, "I'm so sorry about your mom?" And I thought, no, I don't need to say that. I don't think that's what Brahma needs from me right now.
Yeah.
She just needs my presence. That's she doesn't need me to acknowledge. She knows that I know. And that's just not, I don't think that's what she wants. She just wants me, you know? And so I'm just going to go there and be there. And and I don't think that was what you needed from me.
No. So last week, guys, when my, the day my mom, was it the day my mom died, or this is it the after?
After
last Sunday, Katie came over, we hung out, and she brought me the sweet bouquet of roses that she got to pick from a neighbor's lawn. And then she brought me a bottle of white wine. It was really lovely. And we just hung out and talked, not really about my mom, which was exactly what I needed.
Right.
And that was perfect. And so, yeah, I think you're right, Katie. It's about attuning to that person. Not,
I know you well, right?
You know me enough.
If it was, I know you enough that I thought I knew the right, what you needed from me, as opposed to, you know, if it had just been a casual acquaintance who had shared that news, I would have obviously just said, "Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss," you know, because I don't know them well enough to say anything else, you know.
You're scared of people's feelings.
Yes, absolutely.
I think they're terrified. She just lost her mom. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Like anyone cares what you have to say. Like you could possibly say anything that would make it better or worse. It's like, what kind of like rock job thinking is that?
But if I don't say anything, does that mean I'm some kind of,
you know, we're so narcissistic when it comes to other people's feelings.
Yes.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. What about like, if I didn't know someone and I heard their mom just died, I'd say, "How are you?"
Right. That's probably the best thing you could possibly say, right?
Good. How are you? Trust that you're going to use your words, and I'm going to give you this platform to use your words with me and tell me how you're doing. And if you're doing great, that's great. And if you're not, I can ask, my next question can be, what do you need from me right now?
I think we have kind of a newer phenomenon since the pandemic where when people ask you, "How are you?" just in general, it used to always just be that people pretty much just gave very simple answers. "Oh, great. How are you?" You know, but then people started kind of like being more honest, you know, because a lot of people were really struggling.
Yeah.
And so they would be like, very good.
Yeah. Like, even at the grocery store or whatever, you know? And then I think that's kind of bled into, like, I think people tend to be a little bit more honest about, not everybody's up for that. Not everybody wants to hear, really actually hear how someone is doing, right?
Yeah.
Because part of it's just, these are just our ways we, there's our social customs where we greet people and we say, how are you, even though we're not really asking, how are you, right?
So,
yeah. And the other thing with the dysfunctional empathy, though, is implicit in that dysfunctional empathy. So when my friends at the grocery store thinking about me, what I'm feeling, which is probably not accurate, to be honest.
Yeah.
When she's having that dysfunctional empathy that's draining her and not helping me whatsoever, the implicit belief underlying that is that hard things are just pure bad.
Right.
Yes.
But to be avoided at all costs.
To be avoided at all costs.
Yeah.
And yet, again, as a therapist, what I see in myself and in everyone else is everything is a double-edged sword. Everything. Every blessing is a double-edged sword. Every curse is a double-edged sword. So my mom dying, does it have to be all bad and suffering? Of course not. Does anything bad have to be all bad? Just like you were saying, that it's not like the fairy tales, that we don't have these mythical archetypes of the hero who's purely good and the witch that's purely bad. Even circumstances in our lives that seem hard aren't purely bad.
No, and sometimes really great things come out of awful things.
Yeah. But if you're having dysfunctional empathy, imagine what I'm feeling, you're not able to go to, oh, maybe there's good in this. You're not able to see that. You're not able to even realize that because you're not talking to me directly. And so you're draining yourself with your dysfunctional empathy that's not helping me. And again, you're probably not going to have it in you.
No.
To really come up to me and go, by the way, how are you doing? And give me what I actually do need. It's so ironic, right? It's like a sabotage cycle.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think I do that like with my kids. Like I think I worry about them, you know, and kind of, but worrying about them doesn't actually do anything for them, right? It doesn't help them. Instead of actually like taking some kind of action to maybe actually help them in some way, right?
Yeah. Well, even reflecting back on my mom who just died, I told my husband today, I said, my mom was, you know, not a good person for me, but I survived her and I am who I am today because of her.
Right.
And as hard as that was, and I wouldn't wish a mom like her on any child.
Right.
I wouldn't be you. It was a double-edged sword, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a weird thing, isn't it?
So, with my dad, I realized that I needed to stop having empathy for him and to start having a boundary so I can have my own grieving process.
That seems really healthy. Yeah.
And it's been good. It's been good. But I didn't realize all I was doing was playing therapist to him. And I was completely like in my own, I guess, denial because I was just attuning to who he was married to instead of who was my mother. And those are two very different people. And I don't have it in me to do that. I'm not bionic. I'm a human. And I need to grieve the woman that was my mother, not the woman who was his wife, who is a very different person, especially in his mind.
Right. So what were those terms again that you said? They were the empathy.
Oh, I call it dysfunctional empathy.
Dysfunctional empathy. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So do you think that plays a role, kind of circling back to your fear of the anger of the people in your life? Oh,
yeah. I think so.
Yeah, I'd have to think on that.
What comes to mind when I think of that, because we said it's like a fire and you're kind of circumventing it.
Yeah.
Is dysfunctional empathy takes away your skin boundary.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So again, I can see 7 clients in a day and have loads of empathy when I'm with them, but I, you know, at the end of the day, I feel great.
You're not emotionally exhausted.
Not a day. Not one bit.
Yeah.
I have a great, you know, skin boundary. I don't have empathy for them when I'm not with them. I have loads of it when I'm with them, mm-hmm. but I'm also sharing it with them. We're sharing their feelings, the feelings together. They're doable.
Right.
I don't like stop myself in the shower and be like, I wonder what Sarah is feeling right now.
Right.
No, I don't do that because right. that's just going to make me sick.
Yes.
And it's not going to help her.
No.
And it's not even remotely close. Honestly, if I did that, I would be wrong 99% of the time. You would be surprised as a therapist. Like I do have clients where I'm like, gosh, I wonder how they're going to do this week. And then that's kind of where I leave it.
Uh-huh.
And then the next session, a week later, they're like doing great.
Right. Right. Like they've done way better than you imagined.
That happens all the time. Mm. So even like our dysfunctional empathy is just so off base is kind of what I'm saying. It's so
right.
Unrealistic. It really is.
It's like our imagination kind of
it's
takes
a
over.
Bad imagination.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
It has a negative bias, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
Kind of like a catastrophizing or something.
Yeah. So yeah, I have skin, and that I think that same skin allows me to apologize to my daughter and not be afraid of her response. I'm not comparing myself to you though. I don't want to do that because the people in your mind aren't people you see on a regular basis, and they're people who the boundaries you have are there for a really good reason.
Right.
So I don't want to I don't want to compare us, but I do think that I have more skin than I used to with that kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I've wondered how you do your job how so well, you know, that's now it makes sense.
It's funny because I've heard therapists talk about, oh, we have to do self-care as therapists. Oh my God. You know, self-care. And I can only see this many clients in a day because I just get so like overwhelmed, and I don't relate to that at all. I'm like, you guys don't have good boundaries mentally then in my mind.
Well, that goes back to there being, I think a lot of therapists maybe aren't so well adjusted, right? Like
there's something off. I mean, I'm not saying I don't engage in self-care. Of course I do.
Yeah.
But there's something off if you're like, oh, I have to cut back on my caseload because it's just, there's too much. And I just feel I'm an empath. And I'm like, that's not a good thing.
No, that's what the person that I mentioned that calls himself an empath is. They say that as if it's this great quality. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm
like, just proud of it.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Because that means I have this enormous heart.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't see it that way, but I don't see it. It's like,
oh, that's funny. That's funny.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I do think it's become a term that people are kind of proud of, and yet it doesn't serve anyone.
No, it's not.
If we're honest.
It's not healthy. It's not. It's
codependent.
Yes. Oh gosh, it's like the definition of codependent.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to be proud of there.
No.
No. Because you're enabling people.
Yeah.
And you're not actually helping them.
Oof. Yeah.
Katie's feeling it right now. Are you reflecting on you right now? Or
I'm reflecting on that person.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Something's got you all like, you know, tight wad right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't see Katie angry very often, you guys. So this is kind of fun to witness or miffed or whatever you are.
Yeah. Just miffed is a good word.
Miffed. Me. She's miffed.
Yeah. But it's nice to see things clearly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
just to be able to see it and name it, and takes away its sort of power, you know.
Which, what are you referring to now?
Just not being affected by that person's great and all powerful empathic abilities. Because I find them kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Contaminating.
Beware of the empaths, folks.
Yeah.
Beware.
Like, beware of the charmers. Also beware of the empaths. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think, do you have anything else to share?
I think that's a good place to...
to land? Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for joining us today, guys. We will talk to you soon. Have a wonderful day.